Welcome to the Hairdryer Treatment Podcast, powered by Kevin Grogan Soccer, Soccer Coffee, and much more. Welcome to the show this week. We're delighted to have J.R. Shivnan on as a guest. J.R. is a former member of the Irish Consulate, amongst many other things he has done in New York City. He talks a lot about sport in New York City and also mental health issues and some resources on how to deal with different issues like that in New York. It's a fantastic piece. So after the break, we have J.R. Shivnan. The Hairdryer Treatment Podcast is proudly sponsored by Rezl. Rezl is the market-leading, academically validated VR training and cognitive development tool for elite football and is already installed at world-leading clubs. Rezl.com. Hi, Jer. Welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing, Kevin? How are things?
Very good. So really appreciate you coming on. We're kind of primarily going to talk about sport in New York City and that how that helps kind of people settle into a city like New York and create a sense of community. But before we start, Jer, why don't you tell our audience a bit about yourself, where you grew up, how you ended up in New York?
Yeah, sure. So born and raised in Roscommon in the west of Ireland and went to college in Dublin. And out of college, after dabbling with a little bit of primary or elementary school teaching, as it's called here in the States, I ended up working for Department of Foreign Affairs, which is, again, equivalent to the U.S. State Department. And in 2012, I was posted to New York, to the consulate here in the city. And part of what, you know, what I would have brought with me as part of my Irish identity was predominantly Gaelic football was my primary sport. I played a bit of soccer too, but as I said, when I came to the city, the deputy consul general was a guy called Peter Ryan, who was a very proud Dublin man and an absolute GAA obsessive. So when he heard that I was in the ranks of the consulate and I played Gaelic football, I was immediately recruited to help him set up a GAA club in the city, Manhattan Gaels. And we dealt, you know, with that, like that would have been the start of a journey for me in terms of seeing how sport connected, you know, the Irish diaspora in a city like New York. It was a very transformative experience for me, you know.
Yeah, now it's obviously New York City. It's an amazing city, but it is a tough city, right, to come over to, depending on your circumstances. I mean, I personally came over by myself, but which was daunting. But I found sport straight away a great way of integrating into the community. Did you find that yourself?
Yeah, very much so. And even from a professional perspective, as well as a personal one, I found sport was very, very important. And the connections and the contacts that I would have made in the GAA, in the city in particular, stay with me to this day in terms of professional contacts. And, you know, that's one side of it. Like, I mean, that was everything from people that operated and worked within the city to guys in different trades and different industries. And when I brought that back to my job as, you know, being a sort of conduit for the Irish people and in New York City, I had essentially had a fantastic phone book, and it was largely down, you know, to the GAA. And in recent years, you know, that's been expanded through my, you know, playing with the over 40s with the Legends and Shamrocks. So that was on the professional side of things. But then obviously on the personal side of things, which is, I think, our experience with sport everywhere we go, at home or whatever, that's where we make some of our closest friends, you know, like where we, you know, you share so many, you know, good times and bad times on the field with these guys, you know, you develop very, very close bonds. And that happened too, both through the GAA and soccer, you know, it was very, very, I can never, you know, state it strongly enough how important a part of both professional and personal having, you know, certainly a team sport to be involved in, was in terms of settlement in New York.
Now, just for kind of, we've a lot of listeners in Ireland and in England and across the world, but for those who wouldn't understand the makeup of sport in kind of New York City, and we'll start with the GAA because there's such a strong presence here. How does that kind of look like in terms of the like socially playing GAA and then the more competitive level, obviously Gaelic Park and you know, teams come over from Ireland once a year. How does that look? Explain to our listeners about that.
Sure. Well, I suppose just to give the full background on the structure of the GAA in New York, there's roughly between 28 to 30 teams at any one time in the GAA. Teams sometimes fold and they reform, depends on who the people involved are, if they still stay in the city. So you have a little bit of flux in that, but generally it's in the participation rate is high 20s in adult men's football. And you know, like, generally, there's four divisions: junior A and B, and then intermediate and senior, with senior being the top division, junior B being the lowest. But all divisions are quite competitive, and you know, you'll find in every division there's some, you know, there's some quality footballers. So it's, you know, like, and all the games are played in Gaelic Park, you know, in the Bronx. So you find it becomes a magnet for like all like very, very disparate Irish immigrants will kind of descend on Gaelic Park, certainly in the summertime. I mean, currently with the COVID crisis, that's all, you know, in flux. We don't know what's going to happen with that. But generally, it's, you know, like during the summer nights, you'll get like maybe two to three games going on the whole time. And like, there is a very, very high standard. You have guys that would have played at the highest level in Ireland that would have, for whatever reason, moved out to the US. Some stay long term, some stay short term. I've had the privilege of playing against all stars and, you know, like provincial players of the year and even current intercounty stars at home. You know, and these guys will be operating at the very top level of the game. So it's, when you're out here, it's a privilege to be able to play in these competitions because you are playing against Ireland's elite sportsmen. So it's a very nice experience to have.
And one of those players was Jamie Clark, who also played for the Shamrocks. But Jamie would be considered one of like an extremely talented player from back home. So that's kind of the level of players that come out here to play, correct?
Absolutely, yeah. You get like there was, you know, like Jamie Clark, probably one of the finest forwards in the country, you know, on his day. Like to see that guy come out here to Gaelic Park, and like, unfortunately, I never got a chance to play against him directly, or maybe fortunately, I never got a chance to play against him directly. But you know, like for a person who's also a huge fan, there was a bit of a thrill coming up against these guys. I remember I would have played against Brian Kavanagh, who was Longford player, he was Leinster Club Player of the Year in 2007. I played against the great Kieran McManus from Offaly, like one of the finest players probably ever to wear an Offaly jersey. And I think he now lives and works as an engineer down in Philadelphia. And he was commuting from Philadelphia to New York to play for the Offaly team in New York. So you get a lot of these characters out here that still love to kind of retain that, you know, sense of camaraderie and, you know, like sense of belonging to their counties and represented them here in New York. The team I played for was Manhattan Gaels. We were a mishmash of guys from all over the country. Almost every county was represented in the club, and basically, you know, what we had in common was we were all based in the city, and a lot of us had very similar backgrounds. We, you know, tended to be people that would have come out here, you know, like working for large multinational companies or working in legal or in for engineering firms or in tech. So there was, you know, there was a kind of a commonality in the background for Manhattan Gaels.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose we couldn't mention GAA without mentioning the Long Haul Bar. Our good friends, Jonathan Cahill and Jerry own that. But they've done a fantastic job, haven't they, with the GAA community for not only people in New York, but people from Ireland coming over. It's kind of the go-to place, which again gives you that sense of community.
Absolutely. And I mean, it's very funny. I for the All Ireland final this year, was it the I can't remember if it was the first game, I think it might have been the first game. Walked down to it absolutely thronged, and I met my next door neighbor who had been recommended to come, another guy that I played football with at home in Roscommon, neighbor of mine, and two of us had to go to a different bar because we couldn't get into the long haul. So its reputation precedes itself and has become a real focal point for Gaelic games in the city. And by virtue of that, then, like, I think the guys that come over will go there and they'll find, you know, they'll find teams to play for. They'll find work and opportunities through that. You know, it becomes, it's almost like, you know, the, like having in a rural parish in Ireland where you have the pub as the centerpiece sometimes of the club where you go to celebrate the wins, losses and draws regardless. So I think the long haul is kind of filling that little niche nicely in New York as well.
Absolutely. And then we're kind of moving on to soccer with the New York Shamrocks. You mentioned you played for the Legends team there, managed by our good friend John Reardon. So the Shamrocks, and you know, people, our listeners will know I've been involved with that fantastic club with a massive history, the longest running Irish soccer club in America. Like, how important has that been, say, for yourself and then just people in general who kind of come over here and find a home in a club like the New York Shamrocks?
Yeah, it's I'm struck. I find it very interesting, like, that, you know, the kind of, you know, there is, like, it definitely caters to a different subset of the Irish diaspora. You know, I think the fact that it's not rooted to a county and the fact that it's based in Queens and it's based in Sunnyside, where there's a real mix of Irish, you know, like, that have come to the city over the last 30 to 40 years, I think, you know, like, you have a very, very different club, and not different in bad or good, but it's a very special thing. You have guys like Owen Sweeney, who's, you know, one of our key guys in our Legends management team, and he's over here 30 years. He's been involved with the club since, like, you know, the mid-90s. And, you know, like, you have this kind of repository and this wealth of just, like, you know, a knowledge of locality and the people who've passed through that locality. And Shamrocks, I think, retains that very well. And I think, you know, it was a big push by, like, some of the newer members in recent years to kind of reconnect with the founders of Shamrocks and you know, to kind of build that tributary of history of New York City and New York City Irish through the lens of what the club has done down through the years, you know. And I've met people, you know, in very different walks of life that, you know, when they say, oh, you're a Shamrock, and they were a Shamrock back in, like, you know, the mid-60s and, you know, in the 70s. And it's fascinating to see how, you know, a club like that is so strongly rooted in a community, you know, and how it's just, you know, it isn't going anywhere. And unlike the GAA, I think, where the GAA, sometimes the clubs can kind of be a little bit of a movable feast. Outside of maybe Rockland, Shenangales, Raymond's and Barnabas, the rest of the clubs can kind of come and go depending on who the person is driving it. You know, like, sometimes they're driven by publicans or they're driven by a guy that comes to the city for a few years. But then you had Shamrocks, which was a real bedrock club, you know, like, the foundations are rock solid. You know, it goes through peaks and troughs like any club, but it has, you know, it's what, we're in our 50th year now and, you know, still going strong. So for me to see that, and to see, like, kind of, you know, this kind of organic Irish community thrive, it's just such a cool thing to kind of be part of, you know, and to be part of it as a legend, as a, you know, like, I'm now a 41-year-old man, like, but, you know, to get to see where the club has been and where it's going is really cool.
And it's so important, isn't it, for, like, the kind of the new generation of, say, the Shamrocks or any club like that, to understand what the history is. And you're right there. I think there was a couple of people in recent times, you know, the likes of Sinead Hennessy, Reardon, you know, Sean McMullen, they made a massive effort, didn't they, to reconnect with the older generation from, you know, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s. And it's easy to kind of get caught up in the present, but it's very important to keep that connection with the past.
Well, it is, because, I mean, if we don't learn from the past, we're doomed to repeat the mistakes. So, I mean, just by having that institution and knowledge fed into the club, and, you know, these guys will tell you about the great days, but they'll also tell you about the bad days and the things they could have done better. And, I mean, you know, something, those lessons are, you know, they're timeless. Like, those lessons, like, pass through the ages. So I think to kind of hear, you know, about the struggles of the club, and it also gives guys who are currently running the club a little bit of confidence to say, we can get through this. We can, you know, there's never a crisis we can't overcome, you know. And also, to enjoy the moments when they, you know, the club has had, I think the club has been extremely successful. Like, I mean, it's two women's teams are, you know, massively successful. There was over 30s team there for a while that was just absolutely crushing it. I mean, even yourself, you had managed those guys. I mean, you took a League Cup success down. Like, I mean, this stuff like has all, you know, the hallmarks of a really healthy club, you know. And I mean, it's a club that's, it's going to continue to thrive and succeed. And I think, you know, through that sort of engagement of all aspects of where the club's been, where it's going, you're going to get like a strong membership, you know.
And although obviously we all are competitive, we want to go out and win, and that's why we play sport, but there's something bigger about what the New York Shamrocks is all about. It's that sense of community, or helping that person that comes over with maybe some work, or if someone's struggling, to have a network of people that can help them and so on. And I think that's what's so great about the club, not just really the results.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, I think there's been, you know, several, you know, examples of that. I mean, the one I'd like to touch on was, on, you know, like, and, you know, we both like the passing of my, you know, the, my teammate Robbie Walsh. And I mean, just how the community and the club rallied around, you know, both, you know, Robbie, you know, like, and his family. And, you know, that was a moment, like, I mean, obviously it was a massive tragedy for the club, but it also was a moment that the club showed itself to be, you know, its true colours came out. Really, this is what the club was about. And I mean, Robbie himself was a key member of not just the teams, but the club, and such a believer in the value of the club. And I think for that, you know, like the club to reciprocate at, you know, for his family at their moment of need, I think was, you know, it summed up everything about Shamrocks. And yeah. I think then to move on to like maybe, you know, like sort of more, you know, like, you know, like a happier time. I think like one of the things when I worked in the consulate that, the deputy consul general at the time, Peter Ryan, was instrumental in forming and was with a large amount of help with Shamrocks, Manhattan Celtic, and Lansdowne Boys in the Bronx, was the Irish American Soccer Hall of Fame. I mean, and again, that was one of these moments where, you know, the clubs had come together and, you know, started to look at like the impact of Ireland and Irish America, you know, through the lens of soccer, you know. And, you know, I think it was an unusual way to look at the Irish diaspora, and a way that has been greatly overlooked. But yet I think that to have, that was, I think 2013 was the first time, 2012, 2013 was the first time that came about. And to have something like that, you know, happen was a very, very important step, I think, for soccer in the city and, you know, maybe in the areas in a wider.
Yeah, and it's important to recognise, you know, the other Irish soccer clubs, the likes of Lansdowne, who have been national champions and have played a, you know, a massive part in what soccer, Irish soccer, is in New York City and nationally. And obviously then Manhattan Celtic, you know, fantastic history, fantastic club and so on. They played a massive part in all of this as well. And then obviously we can't forget the Irish Rovers with Willie Dempsey, fantastic club over the years.
That's right, yeah. I mean, they've been the stalwarts in Long Island, you know, and I mean, ultra-successful club as well. And I think, wasn't it a couple of years ago, Kevin, that the sort of that Irish combined team won the, they won, what cup was it they won in New York? I mean,
yeah, the Copa, the World Cup,
that's,
yeah.
That's right. I mean, you know, there is a real pedigree here. So I would like to see things like the Hall of Fame kind of gain a bit more, you know, traction, and that we, you know, look and see, you know, maybe out into Connecticut and Pennsylvania and try and, you know, like make it maybe more regionalized and, you know, find, because it's amazing when you go to those events. Like one of the things was, you know, is the great Dublin GA manager, Mickey Whelan. And I mean, he's in Westchester Vikings Hall of Fame for soccer, you know? And I mean, yeah, very, very few people would have known that. And that's a moment in, you know, and that experience that he had, he brought that back to GA in Ireland. He brought back, like, you know, training and you know, like conditioning in America was probably light years ahead of what was going on in Ireland in the 70s. So Mickey brought back like a wealth of knowledge to Dublin GAA and definitely kicked them on in respect to their conditioning and how they looked after themselves and their physical fitness. So, you know, I think like if that's something that's worth, you know, these guys have existed in American soccer, and I think it'd be important to, you know, explore and find out what these guys actually, you know, these Irish immigrants come over and what they did and who they did it with, you know. I definitely think it's
also great there that you know, we fight like cats and dogs on the pitch when we play the likes of Lansdowne or Manhattan Celtic or Rovers and so on. But at these events, you know, it's a great sense of us all coming together and acknowledging that we're Irish and we're all in the same boat.
Well, I think if two Irish teams didn't try to take a few clips off each other on a field, there'd be something wrong about it. I mean, at the end of the day, it's great to have healthy, robust rivalries. I mean, that's competition. I mean, that's, you know, we've seen it in Ireland with local rivalries. I think it's great to have local rivalries here in the city too. You know, that's you know, the spice of life is having these guys come up against you. And, you know, it's great then to have these these events organized that you can kind of come together and, you know, interact with these guys in a different way. So it's nice to have that side of things as well with soccer in the States. So it's, you know, I think that, you know, there's a lot, like, you know, for small clubs that probably operate on tight enough budgets, there's a lot we do right, you know, and I think that's something that should be, you know, tribute should be paid to everybody who puts their shoulder to the wheel in that, you know.
Absolutely. And one thing I want to touch on, which is an important topic, mental health. And I want to talk about kind of the resources in New York City for people who are struggling mentally. And it kind of plays into this because, you know, being involved with a team, surrounding yourself with good people, having friends, having people you can call on. But how important is it in a city like New York City, which can be a bit crazy at times? And, you know, there are a lot of people suffering from mental health issues. You know, how important is it to, you know, have these resources and have these networks and teams to help with that?
Well, I mean, I think like the Irish community in New York has always, I mean, you know, even, you know, before like the discussions on mental health were as prevalent or as open as they are in recent years, the Irish community, you know, like through the likes of the Ashling Center, through the Emerald Isle Immigration Center and the Long Island Centers, I think, you know, in some ways it might necessarily have been directly mental health, but it was certainly health and well-being of, you know, the community, the Irish community living here in the city was something that they were very focused on. And even now in the current crisis, where you're seeing, you know, a huge number of, especially young immigrants out of work, like guys and girls that would have worked in bars whose income has been slashed already, you're seeing, you know, the message has been spread around through the community networks that these centers are available. They're, you know, like they're putting real and practical measures in place, you know, to help people in terms of like gift cards for supermarkets, you know, like where people have donated money and they're converting that into, you know, access to, you know, for people that may not have a lot of money that they can access like the basic requirements, you know, to just keep body and soul together for, you know, like over the course of this crisis. I mean, the Irish consulate would have done a huge amount of work supporting that. And I mean, through the Irish government, through the immigrant support group, would have done a lot of work. They funded a lot of these organizations to make sure like that they were providing services to the Irish community out here. And that's young and old. That's like across the board. It's like from pensioners to retirees right back to, you know, our youngest and newest members in the community. Following on from that then, Kevin, you know, like we have Solace House in the city, which again, a lot of the Irish community work very hard to fund that. But that's a hugely important resource dedicated solely to like mental health and, you know, issues, you know. And again, that's something that's, you know, it's an Irish driven initiative. It's in the city. I think it's now maybe gone into its fourth year in the city. And I mean, that's a service that like anybody can access at any time and hugely valuable, you know, to have that. And that, you know, like we're well aware of it and we're able to like point any people that we may believe are suffering, you know, in their lives to kind of to get like to access help and hopefully get them on the right road. I mean, I think as well, you know, from the kind of the very local level, I think it's, you know, I see it with my own club mates, you know, we check in on one another. We make sure like through the messaging groups that we're, you know, that we're all doing okay. Certainly it's been brought into stark relief with the coronavirus crisis, like that, just how important it is to kind of, you know, maintain those linkages with your teammates and your friends during times of, you know, real trouble and real crisis.
Absolutely. Very, very important. Another thing is I've had the give you a big head here, but I have the privilege of listening to you doing some public speaking, and you're exceptionally good at it. Was that something you practiced, or something that was natural to you, or how did that come about?
I would have been on the debate team in school and that, but I think a lot of it would have come from actually my family business. My father is a funeral director, so in a lot of ways, and I would have helped since I was like a young teenager with that business, and I would have been expected to step up and do it. And to a degree, it was a very public front-facing job where you had to speak to people at their absolute worst moments in their lives. You had to speak confidently. You had to manage situations, and you had to, you know, you had to be a kind of somewhat authoritative presence. You know, you were the person who was directing the situation. You knew what was happening. So, you know, like from that perspective, like public speaking was something that you had to develop in that situation. And then after that, it came quite easy. You know, like you kind of realized that, you know, it's just about, you know, keeping it simple, making your point, and delivering it as clear as you can. John Reardon might disagree with that now, but I do try to keep it short and sweet.
And just on the John Reardon thing, he's obviously your manager, and he often talks about how great you do up front as a centre forward. How is it playing for John?
John is a hard taskmaster. I mean, it's he's both Souness and Alex Ferguson simultaneously on the like he's yeah. John's a great guy. Mazef and John would spark off each other to a very large degree on the field, but we're great friends off it. And I think he is an absolute legend of a Shamrocks man. He'll do absolutely anything and everything he can to make that club a success. And he is genuinely a pleasure to play for, because he's a very, very thorough, dedicated manager who gives us 100%. But my God, we can have some fair Barneys on the field.
Absolutely. And then just to finish up, a kind of a bit of a random question, but a lot of our listeners, particularly in America, you know, will be heavily involved in American soccer, youth soccer, and the national teams. The women are doing fantastic. They're very high level from the national team down through the youth setup. What about the men's national team? Can realistically, I mean, never say never, but can the men's national team ever win a World Cup?
I don't see why it couldn't, but I think there would have to be a fundamental structural change at youth level. I think you'd have to, and this is my personal opinion, son. I mean, I'm not by any means an expert in this, but one of the things I've always seen at youth soccer is like they're very, very good technical players, but I have never seen that, you know, that creative maverick. And I think all great teams need that one guy or that two guy. And I think he only comes from kind of not being coached. You know, you'll often hear like even in football, I was watching about a guy, he's going to go high in the draft, a quarterback, Love is his last name. And they said he is an uncoachable arm. I don't know exactly what that means, but I think as a sports person, I think sometimes, you know, there's these just talents like, and they're honed. I'd love to see more street soccer. I'd love to see guys maybe getting a bit of a kick in and having to fight their corner as opposed to it being structured play, you know, like with a coach constantly watching them. I'd love to see kids just picking up the ball and playing and it being a little bit more, you know, that they're able to free think the problems. And I mean, if it gets down to it, that the game gets tough, that they're able to kind of kick their way a little bit out of it too. I think like I think for US soccer to survive, I think they need two or three Luis Suarez's that will just, you know, get it done, a little bit unconventional, a little bit rough around the edges, but just that undying commitment to the cause and also the mental and physical toughness and just like that breathtaking skill. I know it's a lot to ask, like, but I think if they can get players like that and if they can encourage a little bit more free play, I think you're going to see some real, because I think the coaching structures are there to kind of take a rough diamond and put them into a system. But I think they're polishing the diamonds too young. That's my opinion.
I would agree. I think there's probably a lack of people allowing kids to express themselves. And you're right. You need those one or two players in every team that have that ability to make things happen. Jared, that was absolutely brilliant. Really appreciate you coming on the show and taking time out of your busy schedule. Hope to have you on again sometime soon.
Listen, thank you very much, Kevin. Yeah, I enjoyed that greatly. Like anytime I get to talk a bit about sport, certainly in the lockdown, it's a nice distraction to have. So thank you very much, Kevin. Enjoy that.
My pleasure. Thanks, Jer.
Take care. Bye.